I'm not a UFO investigator. I'm a historian who is interested in the UFO phenomenon and the people who make up the UFO phenomenon rather than the UFOs themselves. And in some ways, it's a distinction without a difference.
Ladies and gentlemen, we know!
If the exopolitics movement had the evidence and the proof that they pretend like they have or that they act like they have, then why hasn't the whole thing come crashing down already?
Exactly.
They know it's not going to go anywhere, but they know there's always going to be people to financially and journalistically support them in their efforts that they know will go nowhere, that they can recycle every decade or so. What was great about Bill Cooper is that, I mean, great in an impressive way, not great in a I love the man and you know, wish he had been my spiritual mentor. You want to meet people with some interesting ideas about things. You walk around a blood plasma donation center with a copy of Behold a Pale Horse at 6 in the morning, and you will meet some interesting people who've had some interesting experiences.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. Coming at you with another taped installment of the program, and this edition of the show, my friends, is fantastic, if I do say so myself. Our guest is historian and writer Aaron Gullius, who joins us for a discussion on his book, The Chaos Conundrum, which is a refreshing collection of essays that looks at a variety of paranormal genres from an observer's perspective. As many longtime BOA audio listeners know, I like to take the outsider's perspective on all this stuff as well, so I felt a certain kinship of sorts with Aaron as we examined all of these various paranormal genres. Over the course of this highly informal conversation, we are going to delve into the emerging science of archaeoacoustics, as well as the promising future for cryptozoology, and we're going to spend quite a bit of time smashing the fourth wall of UFO research and talking about the challenges of studying a 60-plus year old field that has no discernible officialdom and a very sketchy history. In addition to all that, we're going to discuss the insanity of exopolitics, the legendary Bill Cooper, and the infamous Behold a Pale Horse, contactees versus abductees, and everyone's favorite UFO event, Roswell. In total, this is a thoughtful edition of the program, reminiscent of our frequent conversations with BOA Audio's regular circle of friends, as we look beyond the here and now in favor of the then, both in the past and speculatively towards the future, with Aaron Gullius. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Aaron Gullius, please allow me to take a moment and provide you with a little background on him. Aaron Gullius is a historian, writer, and associate professor of history at Mott Community College in Flint, Michigan, where he teaches all manner of courses. His newest publication is The Chaos Conundrum, Essays on UFOs, Ghosts, and Other High Strangeness in Our Non-Rational and Atemporal World, from Red Star Books. Previously, he has written in Fandom's Shadow, Being a Doctor Who Fan from the 1990s to Today, a brief e-book exploring aspects of Doctor Who in light of its 50th anniversary. His first book, Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist, Alien Contact Tales Since the 1950s, was published by McFarland Books in May of 2013. He contributed the introduction to the first volume of Post-Human Blues, a collection of writings by the late Mac Toney, published by Red Star Books. And he is currently working on a study of paranormal and conspiracy-themed science fiction television programs from the 1990s. When he is not teaching, writing, or being a husband and dad, you will find him reading comic books and brewing beer, often simultaneously. His website is www.ajgullius.com. Let me spell that one for you, folks. AJGULYAS.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on January 10th, 2014. Aaron Gullius, talking about the Chaos Conundrum on BOA Audio Season 8.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. You're in store, I think, for a very intriguing and enlightening conversation. I've already spent the last 10 minutes talking to this guy, and we finally said, all right, we better start this show. So hopefully folks can dive on in right away. Talking about Aaron Gullius, our guest. He is the author of a couple of books, The Chaos Conundrum, Essays on UFOs, Ghosts, and Other High Strangeness in Our Non-Rational and Atemporal World, as well as Extraterrestrials and the American Zeitgeist. And you can find out more about him at ajgullius.com, and you spell that ajgullias.com. And I just wrapped up reading The Chaos Conundrum last night and really, really enjoyed it. Thought-provoking book. It really leads you into a lot of questions, makes you look at things from a different angle, and he takes a real outsider's approach to all this and looks at things, really pulls the microscope back to a very interesting perspective and looks at things on a big picture basis, which I really do appreciate. And a lot of that can be found in The Chaos Conundrum. Aaron, thank you for coming on BOA Audio. It's long overdue, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tim.
Well, as you know, I presume you've heard some of the programs. We start out with the bio, the background, you know. Who is Aaron Gullius? How did you get involved in all this? What made you decide to, take part in the paranormal circus?
Well, it started when I was a little kid. I mean, not that I had any experiences or anything like that, but one thing I always sort of go back to is when I was a kid, like 5, 6, 7 years old, every Sunday afternoon, my local independent syndicated TV station there in Northeast Indiana would play an episode of the old Leonard Nimoy In Search Of show.
Oh, yeah.
So I started watching that, and I'd see the ones about the Bermuda Triangle and Amelia Earhart, and I think they had one on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction and various flying saucer and ghost things, and that really got me into it. And then as I grew up, like junior high school, I read a lot of books. There was a guy, I don't know if his books are still in print, but there was a guy named Daniel Cohen who wrote a lot of books about paranormal topics that were aimed at young readers. There was one, The World's Most Famous Ghosts, was one that I liked, and there was one called Monsters, Flying Saucers, and Little Men from Mars, or something like that.
Yeah.
That covered the basic, some of the famous UFO stories from the 50s and 60s. And in high school, and as a senior in high school, the X-Files started. That was in 1993. And seeing that and reading Bloom, B-L-U-M, his book Out There, which was mostly about the MJ-12 papers, really sort of piqued my interest. And then when I went off into college, I discovered this new thing called the internet and Usenet forums like Alt, Alien, Visitors, and a lot of the Paranet news groups and a lot of the text files that have been floating around by Bill Cooper and Bill English and Bill Moore and all those guys. And so I sort of got into that John Lear stuff and all the sort of dark, scary alien abduction stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it sort of went from there. And then in grad school, I had narrowed down my master's thesis topics to either pro wrestling in the 1950s or flying saucers in the 1950s. And those pre-YouTube days, I really didn't see how I could get my hands on enough old wrestling footage to actually do enough research on it. So I sort of ended up with the flying saucers by default. But there was a sort of gap in the scholarly literature, as far as history goes, about the flying saucer phenomenon in the 50s and 60s. It gets sort of mentioned and name-dropped here and there, but apart from David Jacobs' Flying Saucers, I forget the name of the book, the UFO Controversy in America, that I just glanced at my shelf, the UFO Controversy in America that Jacobs wrote back when he was a UFO guy, before he became the abduction, hypnosis, bizarre mind games with women guy that he ended up becoming.
Prior to his ascension, which was prior then.
His ascension. Actually, speaking of Jacobs, I met him when I was an undergrad. I went to Hanover College in southern Indiana, and the advisor of our history student club there was, he was a UFO buff, and for our spring speaker, we brought in David Jacobs.
Oh, wow.
And he had just published The Threat. The Threat was just coming out. Secret Life had been out for a couple years, and The Threat came out, and we had a little Q&A session with him and had dinner with him, and that was kind of cool. Just a few of us students and our advisor and David Jacobs, and then he did his usual talk about the alien abductions, and it was a weird experience meeting him, because even then I was very interested in the contactees much more than I was about the abduction phenomenon, and he was so sort of arrogantly dismissive of the contactees, and then an hour later he's up on stage talking about how there's X percentage of alien human hybrids living on the earth right now, and they're going to suck out our souls or something like that.
Yeah,
or just thinking that you really should not be too dismissive of too many things when you're up there saying what you're saying. So it's been a lifelong interest, really.
Okay. I mentioned here when I was talking about the book, you do take an outsider perspective, just like I do. It's kind of a difficult transition in a way, because once you sort of begin producing content, then you kind of have to keep a foot in both camps, if you will. You know what I mean? You're for better or for worse, whether you like it or not, you're now in the field.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of awkward because I don't want to be. It's not something that this isn't a sort of permanent career path. It's very much a sideline for me. The writing, I mean, I teach at a community college, and that means we don't have, breaks in our teaching to do research. All the research and writing I do is very much on top of a full teaching load. So I don't have a lot of time to go out and be UFO guy. And, I mean, I get laughed at enough at meetings, the UFO guy. But it is very difficult because, you go on these podcasts, and I've done a lot of really fun interviews, and I have to sort of remind the host that I'm not a UFO investigator.
Right.
I'm a historian who is interested in the UFO phenomenon, and the people who make up the UFO phenomenon rather than the UFOs themselves. And that is, that's a distinction, it's in some ways it's a distinction without a difference, because you end up having to have some sort of view about the phenomenon, because honestly that's what people are going to ask you. What do you think about these flying saucers? And when I was writing the Contact ebook, Extraterrestrials in the American Zeitgeist, and when that came out, I mean, my colleagues, relatives, friends are like, well, do you talk about what you think about the flying saucers? And I'm like, it's not that kind of book. It's a straight sort of cultural history thing. And so in a lot of ways, the chaos conundrum is sort of, I've described it to friends as like, okay, you sit me down, you buy me a beer, and you say, so what do you think about all this?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is. $9. There you go. It's the price of a good beer. So you get the whole thing right there without having to spend time with me, which is a bonus. But it's like you don't want to talk to me about this. Just read the book and come talk to me afterwards.
Well, if you're anything like me, it's when you're at the bar and you're having the beer, the last thing you want to talk about is this stuff. But sometimes people bring it up and you're like, I don't want to get into all that right now.
Yeah. it is a lot like that. And it's especially right after you're done writing it, or for you, I suppose, right after you're done with a series of interviews, or when you've gotten done reading a bunch of stuff, it's you just want to break from it for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, that's the nice thing is with the huge gaps between getting something written and having it published, by the time the book's come out, I'm usually recharged and ready to talk about it again. So that's a good thing. But yeah, it's a weird sort of, like you said, you sort of have a foot in both camps. You're the, you know, outside observer of the people, but you're also one of the people you're observing. There's a weird sort of, you know, Heisenberg principle going on there where you can't quite be as much of an outsider as you want to be or that you should be.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I've sort of struggled with it myself, you know, where you start out as a fan, but then you become part of the fabric of it all, whether you like it or not, you know. It's a question I ask myself not every day, but certainly a few times a year. Would it have been better just to stayed a fan? But what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, but, you know, as a fan, you don't get to talk to as many cool people as you get to talk to when you're sort of on the fringes. And for me, the very, very, as I told a friend today, I'm like, you know, G-list paranormal personality here. You know, I'm about as far on the fringe as you can get, but I've talked to some interesting people. I've been on Radio Mysterioso a couple times. I've gotten to know Paul Kimball. I'm talking to you. You know, there's some cool people you meet. So that's something that as a fan, you wouldn't necessarily get the opportunity to do. So, you know, there's pros and cons.
Right, exactly. Well, the odd thing about the paranormal, we've talked about this on the show before, I think with Greg, but I don't recall who, but you can meet a lot of these people, you know, even the A-list, like celebrities of the paranormal are really not actual celebrities, so you can, you can email Stan Friedman and you'll hear back from him. Or you can reach out to like David Icke and he'll probably get back in touch with you. I mean, that might be a different
case, that's not something I want to do. because I'll just make some smart ass remark about Boxcar Willie or something. So being a lizard person. So, you know, but yeah, I remember when I was in grad school, I think the one, sort of current UFO superstar I did do some correspondence with, just to clarify some of his views, was Richard Boylan. I don't know if he's still around, but he's doing a lot with this whole Indigo Children thing.
Oh God!
And he is very much into the positive vision of the ETs, and that the only thing stopping us from having universal harmony is the government, you know, not admitting the truth. It's like he thinks the exopoliticians are a little too cynical. It's almost that level of wide-eyed belief. And so I asked him, you know, some things about contactees, and he, you know, assured me that many of their stories were absolutely true and were covered up by the cabal or whatever. So it was like, well, okay, that's wonderful. But, yeah, very strange.
Well, I have a lot of sort of ideas like that in the notes here about I don't even know what you'd call it, the faulty mental games that are going on in the examination of these phenomena. But the first thing I wanted to ask you about, because Nick points it out, Nick Redfern wrote the foreword to The Chaos Conundrum, he points it out as being particularly intriguing, and I was also very intrigued by it when I got to it in the book, but I want to know more, and that is this archaeoacoustics that you talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Because it sounds really promising, but I've never heard of it before, and I'd like to know more about it.
It's weird, and I'm by no means an expert. Some of the reading I've done on it, you know, you get halfway down the page or halfway through the article and there's, you know, all sorts of graphs about, you know, acoustic waveforms, and that's when, you know, they sort of lose me. But it's basically an idea. It's also back in the 70s, it was known as the stone tape theory.
Okay.
And there's actually a British horror movie or suspense movie sort of in the classic Wicker Man mold of these early 70s British films called The Stone Tape, where there's these evil forces sort of embedded in the structure of this house itself, which is very interesting. If your listeners are Amazon Prime members, The Stone Tape is available for free viewing through the Amazon Prime thing, which means it's probably on Netflix as well. But it's a film worth checking out. But it's basically the idea or the theory that if you flood an area, say like Stonehenge or some sort of stone circle in Europe, something sufficiently old with certain frequencies. I think one of the examples that's been used is something called pink noise. You know, we have white noise and gray noise. There's also pink noise, which is a certain frequency. That if you, that you can, like, pick up acoustic patterns for how spaces might have been used, aurally. Now, I'm spelled, you know, A-U-R.
Yeah, yeah.
Things you hear. Not orally.
Yeah, get your mind out of the gutter, folks.
Yeah, I know. I'm a pervert, but, I don't want to know how Stonehenge was used orally. That's,
yeah, I'm
that's
sure it was.
But sort of licking the rocks and things. But,
oh, God.
yeah, it's so I didn't get much sleep last night.
It's all right.
So there's this notion that you can sort of hear or record audio waveforms that come back after these things have been flooded with these certain frequencies, and it can tell us how these spaces might have been used. Now, this ranges from very sort of straightforward archaeological expressions, like some spaces in India, if they've found that, you know, when certain frequencies are aimed at parts of a particular temple or these pillars in this temple, that what bounces back are the tones in sort of standard Indian musical scales, classical Indian musical scales. So there's things like that, that the people who built these things might have had audio purposes for the structures they constructed. It's just another way to look at these spaces. But there's also, and this is more the fringe of this investigation, is the idea that things that happened in the past might be in some way recorded on the structures around them. And so that if we find the right frequency, we can sort of unlock what happened in the past. And that maybe some expressions of hauntings, in fact, might be incidents from the past, voices, conversations, cries for help, whatever, that might have been embedded in the structures around them. So it's a way to take this sort of traditional idea of hauntings out of the realm of the spiritual, this idea that, you know, the soul or a bit of the soul that got left behind or something like that, and move it into a realm that someday in some way might be actually, you know, successfully subject to repeatable scientific testing and observation, which would be far ahead of where most ghost investigations are now. I have friends who are ghost investigators, and they do all sorts of amazing things. But you know, it's never, and I think they would admit this, it's, you know, it's hard to get the same result twice. With the same result with, you know, different people going in. You know, people have different experiences because we bring our own psyches into that space as well. So it's just a different way, I think, to look at hauntings and to look at the idea of ghosts, not so much as bits of soul left behind or spirits that are floating around, but as, you know, the accumulated sort of sediment of human habitation over the course of millennia or centuries or even decades.
Is, like I said, I never really heard about this. Is anyone actually out there trying to do this? I mean, you'd think that this would be all over these shows and stuff, because...
The thing is, the people who are doing it are actually trying to be fairly circumspect about what they're doing. I've got a post on my website from back in December, so it's like halfway down the page, on some background on some archaeoacoustic stuff. There are two men. One guy is Paul Devereaux, and another one, John Wozencroft. And there's a link there on the website that people can get to, and it's the website where a lot of these articles are. It's landscape-perception.com, and there's a lot of really interesting background and information about all the background of this archaeoacoustics thing. Not necessarily the paranormal side of it, but the actual science side of how archaeologists are using technology to determine how sound was used in these archaeological places.
Right.
So on my website, which I'm sure will be linked from yours, they scroll down to the posts from mid-December. I've got a link there. I first heard about it from comic writer and novelist Warren Ellis. He wrote about it on his website a few years ago and mentioned some of this stuff in connection with the musician Julian Cope, who'd British musician Julian Cope, who'd done some work on ancient British paganism. And so I just sort of filed that in the back of my head. This was probably about 4 or 5 years ago or something. And then when I was working on this part of the Chaos Conundrum, the essays that make up this book, I was like, wait a minute. That, you know, thing A has plugged into thing B and reminded me of thing C, and I sort of went back on the net and found this stuff. And it's fascinating, and a lot of the sciencey part of it is way over my head.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But there's a lot of information out there. It's just being talked about in the fringes of archaeology rather than in the fringes of the paranormal. So I think those are two worlds that haven't quite, there's a gap between them that hasn't quite closed. So maybe, hopefully there's going to be some more work coming out of this in the next few years.
It sounds promising. It's a different approach to things, which I like, which is a sort of a theme that comes up in the Chaos Conundrum too, that it's difficult sort of to get new ideas going in the paranormal,
right,
especially nowadays. I've talked on the show about this malaise of ufology and the UFO phenomenon, but it's kind of creeped into a lot of other genres, let's say. Other now that I'm saying that, I kind of am backtracking a little bit on that, because the other genres they're getting a little bit hotter while ufology stays at this plateau that it's been at for the last, like, 20 years.
Yeah, I think, you know, the last sort of high watermark, I think, and this is something that is incredibly debatable, but I think the last high watermark really was that Roswell 50th anniversary back in 97. As far as mainstream attention on these things, that was huge. I mean, front page cover stories in, you know, Time and Newsweek and the old U.S. News and World Report, and it was out there, and people who normally weren't into these things were into these things.
Hmm.
And I don't know, I think there's a case to be made that September 11th really shifted things, because all of a sudden, you know, I mean, maybe this is just me, but suddenly flying saucers didn't seem that important. The world politics, foreign policy, everything went from being this sort of pleasant but muddy post-Cold War, well, what are we going to do with ourselves now, to this sort of, you know, non-stop, never-ending global war on terrorism and this sort of decade of fear and uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And the paranormal stuff, to a degree, went back into the fringes. Now, recently, in recent years, what we've seen is it comes back in the popular culture, but it's coming back in ways that aren't necessarily good for it. You see a lot of these reality shows, you know, ghost hunting shows and UFO chasers or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of
And what that really does, I think, is it sort of highlights just how, in a lot of cases, and I haven't seen all these shows, but it highlights how kind of goofy and inconsequential and inconclusive some of this stuff is. And so the really good, important research and stories that have been out there for the last 60 years are kind of getting lost in what fits into an hour or a half hour show on cable that meets what the network and the advertisers think they want to see and think the public wants to see in a show about the paranormal. So I think a lot of the depth is getting lost in a lot of sort of gloss and glamour and superficiality. Of course, I say the same things about, you know, what the History Channel does with history. It's the same sort of thing. We've taken interesting, crucial events in whatever topic you have, and then you sort of extract 38 minutes of, you know, fun, highly advertisable crap that the
yeah,
general public thinks is interesting. It's fine for what it is, but what it is isn't very useful, in my opinion. I mean, if people
right,
like it, they like it.
It's sort of like, I was thinking about this having read the book, and we were talking before we got on the air about professional wrestling. We must confess to the folks, but part of the, and how these are sort of parallel worlds, and part of the issue, I think, with the paranormal in a lot of ways is, to break it from that analogy, it's kind of like an episodic TV show. It's kind of like Lost or even more, or professional wrestling or soap opera, where you can,
right,
it's hard for people to just jump right into it. And once you get into it, you have to learn all about the backstory of all this stuff. And so and along the entire spectrum of the fields are people who've been, you know, who've been watching since the 50s, you know, or people who just picked it up through X-Files. So they don't know about all this stuff. So and then you're getting into all these different ranges of knowledge of the show, for lack of a better term.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Another parallel would be comic books.
Exactly. I mean,
if anybody out there picked up an issue of the X-Men in the 1990s, you would have no idea what was going on for those 22 pages. And back before the days of Wikipedia to tell you, you know, exactly who all these people are, it was very, very difficult. There were no easy jumping on points. And, I think thinking about ufology, for example, I think ufology out of all the paranormal fields is the one that fits this best. Although the Bigfoot stuff has been incredibly convoluted, and the JFK stuff as well. But ufology really does have this sort of episodic sort of peaks and valleys of popularity and things that that have gone on over the last 60 years or so. And if you have a sort of natural inclination to do lots of research into what happened in decades past and try to construct a narrative out of all of these different things that have been said and written, you know, you can figure out pretty much what's gone on as far as what the field has done, which I think is why I, as a history guy, as a historian, find it so interesting, because there's so much documentation to go back and look at. But for people just coming into it, it's, well, I remember how I was back when I was, you know, 17 or something. It was impossible. Everything I read, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the holy grail of information.
Yeah,
and then I read something else, is like, oh yeah, you read that? Yeah, that's a hoax. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I know that's a hoax now. And then I'd read something else. Well, we're not sure it's a hoax. You know, some more people are looking at it. And so pretty soon, I think the MJ-12 papers are the best example of that sort of thing, where you're not sure if it's the coolest, most secret, awesome thing ever, or if it's cool and awesome because it's such an awesome hoax. So I sort of go back and forth, and you know, it's hard to maintain an interest in it without becoming some sort of psychopath, or, you know, having it be an expression of your already existing psychopathology, right? You know, you become sort of this obsessive recluse that people can't relate to, because all you can do is talk about this guy, but if you read this other guy, you know,
right,
opinion,
it's
of
a
him,
rabbit hole. Like, once you go, you start going into it, and it is like comics and all that other stuff in a way. You know, it's like people who binge watch TV shows. It's once you get into it, you have to keep getting the next thing. You read one book,
right,
and then there's references to some other guy, and you're like, well, who's this guy? And then you look into that, and next thing you know, it's 6 months later.
Right.
So
right.
It's a crazy thing to go down. And I'm sure all the people listening right now are of the same experience. I'm sure they're this far gone, like you and I are. They're way.
You know, And honestly, I mean, maybe this is the way it was for you with starting up BOA and doing the podcasting, but I wrote these books and I'm continuing to do this work because I feel like I need to come out with some sort of concrete product to sort of justify all the time I've spent looking at this. Because otherwise it's like, you know, I've spent all this time on, you know, Usenet archives over the years, reading these arguments back and forth back in 1996. And what have I got? It's sort of like, what have I got to show for it? Well, now I got books. So, and you've got a podcast and, you know, we've got these things, but for a long time, I you know, drift away from it and then drift back to it, you know, as my interest in it sort of ebbed and flowed over the years. But I always tend to come back to it. And the nice thing is it's big enough. You can come back to, different things. I mean, I'm about as sick of contactees as one can be, at this point. I say that and then I'm thinking, well, really, am I? But probably not. But the, you know, it comes and goes.
I know what you mean.
Comes and goes.
Yeah. Like I said, when I first asked you for the bio, the background, it's a circus. The whole thing is it's a strange circus, and that's why I've already enjoyed talking to you so far, because we do share a definite outsider perspective on all this, because I try not to really get into these things. Although I think like like me, if there was one area, it would be the UFO phenomenon. That is probably my wheelhouse of topics.
Yeah.
And you do a good job of dismantling the exopolitics movement in the Chaos Conundrum, and I agree. I found myself shaking my head in agreement with a lot of the points. It's a very prickly realm, because...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think all the work I did researching the contactees and all the contactee stuff from, you know, not just the 50s and 60s, but the channeling stuff from the seven, like Tuella's books from the 70s and 80s and all the Ashtar stuff. There's nothing new in exopolitics. There's nothing new at all. They've taken the optimism and the space brotheriness of the contactees, and they've taken the conspiracy stuff from the 80s and 90s, and they have picked and chosen from things that go well together. They've put those together, and they've called it something new and exciting. And it's not. It's the same old crap. It really is. I mean, oh, there were crash saucers. Oh, the government's hiding technology. Oh, this. Oh, that. This is the same thing we've been talking about for the last 50, 60 years in one way or another. And the citizens hearing or whatever they had this last year,
yeah,
was just the most, I mean, no offense to anybody out there who thought this was a great idea, but this is one of the most asinine displays of nonsense that I've ever seen. I mean, it was substantively no different than the big press conferences they'd call back at the National Press Club, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And just like that, they just like those things, they basically rent a room, bring in a bunch of people that we've mostly heard before and either accept or dismiss them before, and put them all in one place and pretend like they're doing something phenomenal. The twist this time, as you and your listeners know, was to have some, you know, washed up former politicians there to be sort of a pretend congressional committee. Hmm. Well, I'm not sure how much credibility a real congressional committee would have. You know, much less, you know, these sort of, you know, has-beens and never-weres that they brought up.
And paid.
So it was,
I mean, it
and paid.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What, 25 grand a piece or something like that?
Something along those lines.
If I were, you know, Mike Gravel or Carolyn Sheeks Kilpatrick, I'd be like, hell yeah, give me 25 grand to sit there and nod serenely as these nut jobs talk. Yeah, I'll take that money. But,
well, I guess, you know, it's a double-edged sword in a way. I understand why they paid them, but it also it speaks to the futility of all this that they had to pay them.
Yeah.
That there was no one.
Yeah.
That there was no one that would, from Congress, that would just come for free because they thought it was a good idea.
Yeah, and you know, we're only 10, 15 years out from, you know, when there was a serious talk in Congress of having another sort of Condon Committee style investigation. I forget the guy's name, but the congressman from New Mexico who really pushed for you know, some sort of investigation. And, you know, it didn't happen, or at least it didn't happen to as great a degree as maybe it should have. And a lot of people have placed the blame on the exopolitics crowd and the sort of I'm a UFO lobbyist type guy. What's his
Steve Bassett.
What's his face? Steve Bassett. You know, I'm a UFO lobbyist. Well, you know, that's great for you, but what does that actually mean? You know, it becomes almost an exercise in sort of, it's very cynical. It's just a very cynical, you get the impression that, I mean, I'm cynical about it. I mean, they know it's not going to go anywhere, but they know there's always going to be people to financially and journalistically support them in their efforts that they know will go nowhere, that they can recycle every decade or so. Boy, I sound really sort of bitter and angry about it. I mean, I don't really care that much, but it does irritate me that, I don't know. Are our memories so short that we think that this time we get these witnesses together and this is going to be the big breakthrough? Or do we really believe that all of this disclosure is just around the corner, like they've been telling us for the last generation?
Hmm.
I don't know if part of me wants to say that the Greers and the Bassetts of the world probably don't believe it either. But, you know, they've, you know, it's their bread and butter. But that's sort of the cynical viewpoint. Maybe they believe every word of it. Maybe they believe some of it, but know how to spin it in a way that makes it look better to the public, or at least to the public they're aiming at. I don't know. It's very frustrating. The exopolitics thing is very frustrating.
Yeah.
To me, because there are good witnesses and good, interesting stories hidden in there, almost literally hidden between the usual nonsense. And, things like Bentwaters, that case and, you know, the whole Rendlesham Forest thing and the Cash Landrum case, there are some really, really interesting stories that, even if they don't point to extraterrestrial visitors and physical spacecraft, point to things that are very interesting as far as the history of how citizens have related to their governments and the relationship between the public and defense establishments. There are a lot of deep, dark stories that are waiting to be told that have become bound up with the flying saucer UFO phenomenon. And this is a very sort of, Greg Bishop-esque sort of approach, but, you know, people who need to keep secrets are aware of the strange ideas that people on the fringe have, and they will use those strange ideas in order to hide what they're doing. And I think that's a really interesting side of it that the exopolitics movement misses, that there is disinformation, there is secrecy, that yes, this is true, but it's not because they're hiding secret alien technology. It's because they're doing A, B, and C that might be illegal, unethical, or a bad use of taxpayer money, or actively harmful to the American public, or anybody else's public. So I think there's all sorts of kernels of truth in these things, but not for the reasons that some of the exopolitics crowd might think so.
Right. See, my issue with the exopolitics, and you hit it on the head in the book too, is they've jumped ahead and haven't finished the job of actually proving UFOs. And so
yes,
they can't show their work, to use a teacherly term, and they just insist that they have the answer without actually having anything to actually prove that UFOs are real. And it's where,
right,
somewhere along the way, the UFO research community, and there's still people doing the work, but they lost the plot a little bit here, because it's our job to prove this. If we're UFO, you know, us being UFO researchers, let's say, not you and I.
Right.
You know what I mean.
Right.
It's up to the UFO community to prove it. And they haven't proven it yet. And so I feel like they've almost thrown their hands up and now they're like, just tell us the answer already.
Right. There's a whole set of a priori, you know, assumptions that go into most of the UFO field now. And then the biggest one is the one you mentioned, that there are space aliens out there in what we call structured craft, coming and sort of buzzing the planet and making contact. This isn't even something that's discussed, because you know, the vast majority just assume this is the way things are. And all the debates, you know, center around the degree to which the government has knowledge and isn't sharing knowledge and what that might mean. But we haven't quite gotten to the point where we can just accept the existence of these things just as a general principle. Like you said, we haven't done the basic work of proving the extraterrestrial, let's emphasize the word, hypothesis. Which is a hypothesis that hasn't been proven, and evidence is not proof. And absence of evidence might not mean evidence of absence, but it's still an absence of evidence, right? So,
exactly.
You know, there's, you know, you can, you know, talk till you're blue in the face about, you know, what this great contact with the extraterrestrials will mean for humankind, and how many different varieties of extraterrestrials are walking around, and the short grays and the tall whites and all of these different things. But in the end, there's no absolute proof that any of this is real, which has got to be frustrating for those who sort of operate as though it has been. Although not as frustrating for those who still realize they need to prove that. Really frustrating for them. For those who already just assume it, they can just go on and talk about, you know, their Philip Corso, you know.
Yeah, those people are in denial.
Yeah.
The people,
right,
you know, Then there's like you and I who acknowledge the elephant in the room, or I like to call it ufology's dirty little secret, which is that we don't know what UFOs are.
They don't
ever want anyone to know that we don't know. It's just the craziest part about it.
Right. It's frustrating because I think the fun is there's two things that are fun about this whole UFO phenomenon for me. One of them is studying the people and sort of tracking the stories that have come and gone over the years and how these stories have developed and the connections between them and how they tie into the wider culture and how the wider culture influences them and is influenced by them. That's the one fun part of it, and that's the sort of scholarly bread and butter stuff that I've done. And the other fun part of it is trying to figure out what all of these things might actually be. Whether it's aliens from space, whether it's crypto-terrestrials, whether it's time travelers or interdimensional beings or swamp gas, or I'm in Michigan, so I gotta say swamp gas.
There you go, yeah.
Swamp gas. That's what it was down in Hillsdale back in the day. poor J. Allen Hynek having to say the swamp gas thing. Never really lived that down. But, whatever it is, it's interesting. And I think the discussions about what it might be are sort of on the speculative side of it. That's the fun part for me. Not necessarily, accepting that it's this one thing and then going from there, because, we have no way to accept that. It really is very much akin to religion in that sense. There are huge chunks that people are simply taking on faith. And they have what they think is proof, but it's not really proof for anybody outside that belief system. So, what they consider proof isn't necessarily what somebody who needs to be convinced would consider proof. Much like, you can have all the logical proofs of the doctrine of the incarnation and transubstantiation or the nature of the Buddha, or, the teachings of Muhammad, the teachings of Allah through Muhammad. You can have all of these things, but for an outsider to accept that, there has to be a measure of faith. And then the proof becomes proof, if that makes sense.
No, I know
what you mean. But to those who are outside of that system, it's not proof. It's simply articles of belief.
Exactly, and that's what I think that they don't understand, these people in the exopolitics. Or maybe they do understand it, but they're just saying, we give up, we want you to tell us the answer. It's like if you want the government to tell us the what they know about UFOs, why don't we prove what they are and then bring that to the government and be like, hey, dude, we have a UFO here, so do you mind telling us what's going on? Then you'll see disclosure. It'll happen overnight. But you have to do the work.
Yep. If there is something there to be found, you have to find it.
Exactly.
Because if there's no compelling reason for the government or elements within the government, if we take that tack, elements within the government to tell you what they're hiding, why should they? If you don't have the evidence of what they're hiding, they're not going to come forward with it. You have to force their hand.
Hmm.
And for all their talk, the exopoliticians have not had enough information to force their hand. It doesn't matter if Leon Panetta or John Podesta back during the Clinton years thought they should declassify some stuff and were also fans of the X-Files. That is not evidence, now that, so-and-so or whichever one of the guys is one of Clinton's or Obama's advisors. What year is it? One of Obama's advisors. Just because, John Podesta is still hanging around does not mean the disclosure is imminent. He was active in the last Democratic administration. He's active in this one. That's just politics. The fact that he was an X-Files fan and thought it would be nifty if the government declassified certain files, and that's great, but that doesn't mean that that's not a smoking gun. If the exopolitics movement had the evidence and the proof that they pretend like they have or that they act like they have, then why hasn't the whole thing come crashing down already?
Exactly.
That's what I want to know. Where's my flying car? if all of this technology is out there waiting for the right moment for the right people just to say, okay, release the Kraken, everybody gets jetpacks, and everybody goes to Venus or whatever, why hasn't it happened? I'm being remarkably dismissive of these people, but, you know, it's a Friday, long week. I can be dismissive. There's like 3 feet of snow on the ground. I'm feeling dismissive of exopoliticians today. So.
No, yeah, well, you're in good company, because that's how I feel. I find them very frustrating. And the difficult part, yeah, too, is they've kind of taken over ufology, which is the disappointing part. You know, and even the good people that I think are doing good research or good work, a lot of them end up having to co-op with the exopolitics crowd. And it's,
yeah,
not good. It's just not a good scene.
No.
Right now.
It isn't. That reminds me, last time I was on with Greg Bishop, we sort of talked about the fact that, you know, somehow we all sort of did this sort of, you know, all of us right-thinking people, that's, you know, yeah, I'm not arrogant at all. All of us right-thinking people, you know, sort of had this Rip Van Winkle moment. We woke up, and suddenly exopolitics are not just the nut jobs over in the corner. They're the establishment.
Right.
And there's been this shift to exopolitics from the previous paradigm, which was the sort of NICAP MUFON model of, we're going to collect a whole lot of sighting reports and filing cabinets, and we're going to reach a critical mass at some point where we have some sort of answer, to, like we've said, you know, we assume that this is what it is, and this is what it means for humanity. And somehow, I think we all sort of got, you know, frustrated or tired of the whole field and sort of got away from what was going on. We you know, take a peek back in. Certainly I did. And I can't believe that Stephen Greer, with what used to be his C-SETI group back in the 90s, paying $3,000 to shine flashlights up in the sky to attract flying saucers, is now some sort of elder statesman. You know, it's weird. It's weird, and it's frustrating, and it's kind of sad. But on the other hand, there's not going to, I think it's almost a good thing, because we're maybe getting away from the idea that there's going to be one sort of granddaddy of the field or one organization that's going to lead the way in solving all these things, sort of the NICAP MUFONism of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. That maybe we're getting back to the idea that maybe this is for small groups to think about. This is for individuals to contemplate. That maybe groups of thinkers like Jacques Vallée's Invisible College idea, small groups of people working together outside of the spotlight are putting pieces together and forming conclusions that they will reveal when they're ready, rather than, you know, signing up for something, paying a bunch of money, and getting, you know, a newsletter full of sighting reports every month, as being the way forward. So, I don't know. Things are changing. Things are definitely transitioning to something else. And I think it remains to be seen whether or not what's coming is good or not. In the end, I'm not sure flying saucers are important enough for us to be too worried about what's happening next in ufology. I just hope it's entertaining enough and sort of media enough to continue supplying material for me to write about. And I'm sure you hope there are people worth interviewing in the future as the field goes forward. So.
Exactly.
Who knows what's going to happen to it?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't keep me up at night, the direction of ufology, don't worry.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there are people, I'm sure there are people,
I'm sure
who are. Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Deeply, deeply concerned about this. And an example is the I think, very recent closing of the UFO updates mailing list that Errol Bruce Knapp had been running for,
sad,
you know, what, 7,000 years or something like that. And, you know, it's... My first reaction when I saw that news was, oh, I remember that. You know, not, oh my gosh, really? But that's still around.
Huh? Yeah.
Sort of like when I heard Mae Young passed away. Honestly, I hadn't seen her on TV in a while, and I sort of assumed she already had, which, nothing against her. It's just not something I was paying a whole lot of attention to. But for listeners, Mae Young is a recently passed away, professional wrestler from way back in the day. So it's, you know, and there were people saying, well, what happens now that UFO updates is gone? I actually saw this conversation on some blog somewhere, and I'm like, I don't know, what happens now that these same dozen people won't say the same things to each other in email all day long.
Life goes on. That's what happens.
Yeah. I sort of subscribed to it and then unsubscribed over a 3-month period back when I got sick of reading all these emails from people that, even if I agreed with them, it's the same arguments over and over and over. And I'm not sure where things go from here.
Yeah.
I really don't. I think the real future for this stuff, the real exciting advances are going to be with our ghost hunting friends and with our cryptozoology friends, because those are things where there's a little more, especially the cryptozoological stuff, there's more to hang your hat on there. I mean, if you actually find DNA from some species that nobody really knew about or thought was extinct or something, that's something that it can stand up to some scrutiny. And I think there's going to be some, interesting advances there, especially as technology advances and mapping and things like that, and DNA sequencing and gene sequencing becoming more readily available and affordable to people who aren't at major research universities. I think we're going to have some answers one way or another on some of that stuff. But I think the flying saucer field has become so convoluted, and I'm not sure if incestuous is the right word, but so incestuous over the last couple decades that, I mean, it's just a giant Gordian knot now. I'm waiting for a giant flaming Alexander the Great sword to come around and hack it all to pieces, but not sure I'm going to like what's left of it afterward.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I've championed... maybe looking at this from a statistical point of view, Nate Silver-esque examination of whatever data we have. That's sort of my bailiwick lately. And obviously, and the other thing is really that I've always been pushing for years is just to improve the public relations end of UFO studies.
Yeah.
But to turn it around to you, I mean, what at the risk of, because we don't want to just completely tear everything down.
No,
without offering solutions.
No.
So what do you think UFO studies, which is a very nebulous sort of term, ufology? I mean, if you had a magic wand, if you had a an endless stream of money or something, I mean, what would you advise if you had a platform to advise these people? What would you advise ufology to do to try and improve what it's doing, which is to try and solve the UFO mystery?
I really like what you said about stats and data, and especially sort of a global effort to provide some really good geographical and statistical data on what kinds of things are seen where and when. And we have all kinds of technology for data visualization now, and I think that could provide some useful avenues to at least more fully understand what it is that we think we've been seeing over the past 60 years and continue to see. And I think part of that approach has to be a willingness to back away, sort of very explicitly and vocally and publicly back away from holding on to the extraterrestrial hypothesis as the only solution. What we have are strange things seen in the skies and attendant phenomenon. I almost want to put abductions and contacts in a separate bucket for now,
Yeah.
But just as far as, straight on unidentified flying objects, let's get a good data handle on what it is, and let's put the raw data in the hands of people who don't care about flying saucers and don't know about flying saucers and aren't steeped in the history of flying saucers. And let's just get the data into the hands of people who can analyze it as data, not analyzing it with a view to proving this, that, or the other, which is what so many people in the field do. So I think the data has to go hand in hand with a sort of redrafted approach to sort of opening it up again, almost like we did back in the 50s. I say we, but people, many years older than us did back in the 50s, where... we've got to figure out what this is. If you or your listeners have ever read it, it sounds like an odd segue, but Gray Barker's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, which was the book that introduced the whole idea of the Men in Black and the Albert Bender mystery to the world. The Albert Bender thing is part of it, but also there's this little sort of narrative thread of a whole bunch of people from different fields poring over these reports back in the 50s and offering a whole bunch of different outlandish ideas about what people might be seeing. And I think we've got to get back to that. We've got to get out of this notion that, you know, how does this data prove that these are spaceships from another planet? Which I think a lot of the organizations have done. Like you said, they assume these are aliens, and so then they look at the data that helps prove that. Let's let the data lead us to conclusions rather than coming to the data with conclusions already made, which sounds like the most obvious dang thing on Earth, but it's honestly really difficult to do. When you're locked into a certain paradigm, it's hard to sort of back out of that. But I think that's what needs to be done. There needs to be a shift in the perception of what we're looking for, and then there needs to be sort of a heavy-duty reliance on as much actual data as we can get. And yes, some of it's going to be subjective because we're dealing with reports that are being made by human beings, which brings each individual's perspective to what they're reporting. But there should be enough meat there to find something. So that's the first thing I would do is I like you focus on data, but I would get that data into the hands of heck, let's drag Nate Silver himself into this and say, Nate, my statistics friend, here's a bunch of information. You and your team just go to town and tell us what pops out at you.
Yeah.
As far as trends and significant, statistically significant things. Not things that might be interesting stories, but statistically significant things. Which is hard for a narrative story guy like me to sort of say, let's look at statistics. That kind of hurts my soul a little bit. But, I've sort of irritated sociologists by saying, it's interesting what you do because it's so boring and horrible. You must be a really interesting person to be able to look at all those numbers and not look at actual people and sort of find that fulfilling. And they're like, at least we have data. What do you have? I said, I have stories and data, but mostly stories because history is all that sociology data made useful, but that's sort of, you know, academic turf wars. But there's a lot of overlap between any sort of professional turf wars and the ufological field. But I think that's what I do. I would emphasize data, and I would emphasize looking at the data divorced from any sort of ideological perspective as much as possible.
It seems like it's a promising direction. I presume they might. I know someone called in. I talked about this with Sharon Hill, like back in September or August or October, and someone called in, a listener, and mentioned that Jacques Vallée did a study like this in the 70s, but that was like 30 or 40 years ago. It's time for with the advancements in the technology and data collection and everything, cry out for a new study like this.
Yeah, and I think this is a function of our ages. I'm 38. I think you're probably younger than I am, but
I'll be 35
maybe not by
in like
too
2 weeks. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you and I both sort of, you know, came of age in the 90s, and we're of the age where if somebody the generation or two older than us says, well, yeah, that was done back in the 70s. I mean, we see this, you know, in our workplaces as well. You know, well, what about this? Well, we tried that. Well, when did we try that? Back in the 70s. I'm like, that's more than a generation ago.
Yeah.
You know, that's the statute of limitations has passed. We can look at these things again because we have, you know, almost 40 years more data, and we have 40 years of technological advances on handling data and especially visualizing data and visualizing data in ways that's understandable to non-experts, so we can draw on people from a variety of fields and they don't all have to be specifically aerial phenomenon data people. But yeah, if you just look at the National UFO Reporting Center, you know, he has his hotline, he has, you know, the latest research reports there. You know, reports for December of 2013, 368 reports, which is significant. Oh, that's only for the first half of the month. But
wow.
Yeah, just about every month, it ranges anywhere from 400 to 800 individual reports that he's getting. And he's just one guy with a non-toll-free hotline that people call. He's not the Air Force. He's not the local airport. He's not the sheriff's office. You're to take all of this stuff and do something with it, besides put it on a website where I can see that, you know, in Tacoma, Washington, people saw a disc for 4 minutes back on September 9th. Well, that's great, but you know, I don't have time to look through all of these things and do something. And there's narrative here, and there's all sorts of really interesting information that I'm not sure anybody is doing anything with other than saying they have it. Which is great if it's 1965 and you're Donald Kehoe and you're running NICAP and that's what you do, because it's a really new thing at that point. But like you said, it's decades later, and we should be doing something with this more than what we're doing.
Well, you touched on something that came up when I was talking to Stan on the holiday special. It's just kind of a different path of the conversation, but you said it where they were. It was a new thing at the time. It's an interesting sort of conundrum that, no pun intended, because the book's the Chaos Conundrum. but it's an interesting sort of conundrum that we find ourselves in as a species, as a collective, as a human race, that UFOs aren't new anymore. And
yeah.
Culturally, it's like we can't get back to that first impression. It's
right.
That's another difficult challenge that the UFO research community needs to overcome, this already preconceived first impression that UFOs made on the human race.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because putting my sort of post-war U.S. historian hat on here, I mean, the whole flying saucer UFO phenomenon just screams space age Cold War. I mean, it's retro. It's almost kitschy in a lot of ways. And if you look back at the 50s and 60s stuff, even the sort of po-faced, serious Donald Kehoe, Richard Hall types, and, it, you know, you've got that, and then you've got the sort of almost, you know, sort of freewheeling beatnik style of Gray Barker and Jim Moseley running out doing, you know, pranking people and hoaxing people. It's very much, phenomenon is always very much of its time, and our response to it is. And it's not a new thing now. And I wonder how you reinvent it, but at the same time acknowledge that there's been this 60-year varied history of different ideas, personalities, theories. Do you, going back to our television analogy, do you pull a Doctor Who and continue it and acknowledge and embrace that history, or do you pull a Battlestar Galactica and junk it and reinvent it for new times with new information? I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek comparing it to fictional things like we have been, but it's very much the part of the problem, isn't
yeah.
it? You know, we have this long history. What do we do with that? You know, if there was anything there that would have solved it, I like to think somebody would have found it and
right.
done something with it.
Exactly.
But if there wasn't, do we keep dragging around this anchor of 60 years of theories and data? Do we keep bringing up Roswell? Do we keep doing it? Do we keep bringing up Roswell as though that's the key that'll solve it all? Because it hasn't yet.
Roswell, oh God, yeah. Roswell will be the Tunguska of of our grandchildren.
Oh God, it will never go away, and it will always be just mysterious enough to keep people coming back. And I think that's one of the things I bring up in the chapter on Roswell in the Chaos Conundrum is what's clear to me is that something pretty interesting happened there in July 1947. And because there is this sort of kernel of that was weird, I wonder what happened. It's never really going to go away. But the further we get away from it, I think the further we get away from coming up with the real answer, or at least a real answer that is accepted by the UFO community. Because no matter what documentation, what witnesses come up, what declassified records might emerge, there are always going to be groups of people who denounce those as clearly disinformation propaganda, because we all know that, you know, blah 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 is what happened. And so it's never going to go away. And like Tunguska, was it a meteor strike? Was it an energy weapon directed through time? Was it an alien saucer crash? Was it some sort of bifurcation in the space-time continuum when, you know, reality split and suddenly, you know, we went off in a parallel universe because of the Tunguska event? I don't know where that one came from, but
I was going to say, would you hear that? That's awesome.
I think I have heard
something like that. I forget now.
I want to say, man, that it just sort of screams Terrence McKenna to me, because he talked a lot about time bifurcation, and I spent a while listening to a whole bunch of his lectures on MP3 a while ago, and that one sort of stuck with me, because he talked a lot about like splitting time streams and time bifurcation and all the other things that somebody who was as clearly high all the time as Terrence McKenna was would talk about. And I say that lovingly, but that the man was on a wide array of drugs, which is part of his charm. And he was charming. I loved listening to his stuff. His stuff with Art Bell was just incredible. Those are some great shows.
I know what it's all about, girls. I know what's happening.
I've been to the limit one time in my life. It took Linda Carter and Bo Derek back to back to make Ric Flair even.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The whole world looks at me. Dallas, Tampa, Charlotte, Greensboro, Tokyo, Melbourne. I am your champion. Learn to like it. I am Space Monk.
I'm styling and profiling.
Kids stealing, wheeling, dealing. Limousine riding, jet flying, son of a gun. Woo, woo, woo.